Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Chris Kraus. She's the author, most recently, of After Kathy Acker. People who've been watching television perhaps know the book that was the basis of the series I Love Dick. She's the author as well of Aliens and Anorexia, a novel I particularly love called Torpor, and another called Summer of Hate. And now she's written a biography, After Kathy Acker. It's published by Semiotext, and it's about the avant-garde writer Kathy Acker. I read many biographies of writers, and there are some in particular that attempt to get inside the writer's process. And now Chris Kraus has written what I think is the best book that I've ever read about the writing process. Who is Kathy Acker?
Kathy Acker was an American writer. She was born in 1947. She died at the age of 50 in 97. She was active between the years, 1972 until her death.
And what kind of writing was she doing?
Well, she did very experimental and raw writing. The kind of writing that until she crossed over into a more mainstream career in the 80s, you would really associate with poetry circles or with avant-garde or conceptual art circles. You wouldn't really expect Kathy's work to be talked about and publicized and discussed and read in mainstream culture. And yet that was something that she wanted very badly and something she achieved.
Well, the yearning was in two parts. First of all, to be an avant-garde and experimental writer and be a woman. This was a very rare thing. And Kathy began to ask herself the question, how do you simultaneously write as a woman and as an experimenter in form and style?
There were plenty of experimental women writers who were her contemporaries. The poet Bernadette Mayer, the writer Susan Howe, I could name a lot of them. But that level of fame and notoriety enjoyed by Burroughs and others was not available to them. Maybe they didn't want it, but Kathy did.
Kathy was trying to see whether she could write novels that would be in their intensity of subject matter as powerful as Jean Genet. She wanted to be a figure in culture as well as a writer about culture.
Yes. And so she took a lot of models from popular culture and learned from them. For a while, she was obsessed with reading Harold Robbins.
Yes.
She wanted, you know, and she read a lot of pulp detective fiction, and she read a lot of, you know, kind of softcore pornography, all those paperback books that were all over the place in the late 60s and 70s. She used those as models when she was just starting to write prose.
She brought a level of pornographic intensity to the subject matter of a young woman's life that had not really been placed there before. How did you find your own style for entering another person so fully? Because one of Kathy's subjects is, can another person be penetrated? Can you and I become one, mentally, aesthetically, fully?
I love that phrase that you use, pornographic intensity. That describes it so well. And I'd never thought of that or heard that before. That Kathy wrote with what you say, yes, a total pornographic intensity. How did I access her? I think it was through the sources. There were the notebooks and the letters. She died in 97, just at the cusp of the digital age, when people were still communicating largely by letter. And a lot of people that she wrote to kept all these letters. There was a tremendous amount of correspondence that I was able to draw from. And so I could see how she would describe the same event differently to three different people. And I used all kinds of documents. I hired a private investigator.
Really?
Yes.
What did they find?
Well, Kathy was very squirrely about money matters and how she was living. She did receive a substantial inheritance in her life, but she never fully disclosed that to anyone. And I felt as her biographer, I needed to know that. You know, where was her money coming from? How much was it? What was the situation? So the PI got the probate documents for her grandmother's will, who she inherited from. So the PI looked up all the marriage documents, the death papers, the inheritances.
Wow. I'm talking to Chris Krause about her book, After Kathy Acker. Now, again, in the same sense as the question, who was Kathy Acker? What do you think of Kathy Acker's writing?
I have tremendous admiration for it. I think after the book, I have an understanding of it that I would never have had before, because I went back and I read each book so closely and looked at it, you know, in relation to other writers and her own life. I unreservedly admire her early work.
Me too.
As a reader and a writer, her later work loses me on some levels, but I understand it now better than I would have.
Now, I love the way in this book, After Kathy Acker, you write using some of the sentences that Kathy used repetitively. For instance, my mother was the most beautiful woman in the world. You use her repetition structures, and then you enter her relation to her mother. Because many people who might have read her book, Great Expectations. Now, all of you are sitting there, I hope, saying, Great Expectations? That's by Charles Dickens. But the essence, at a certain point, of Kathy Acker's method was appropriation. It was something she was pointed toward by one of her mentors, David Anton, who at his classes in San Diego would say the most interesting thing to his writing students. You want to say it?
Yeah. He said, go to the library and steal. At your age, no matter what you want to write about, somebody else has written about it better than you could at this point. So go to the library, steal, cut it up, make your own collage.
And Kathy, well, witness the title, Great Expectations. The first paragraph is nearly verbatim from Dickens's novel, but she then tells us that her mother committed suicide. Those of us who have no way of knowing didn't know that that was true. Her mother disappeared into a hotel room, having spent all of her money, virtually all, her bank account was almost empty, and killed herself. It was the same year that Kathy's wealthy grandmother died and left Kathy the inheritance that you were talking about. Now, why was it important for Kathy to keep it a secret that she had money?
Well, I think a lot of her best work was her early work, and that was done when she was in a position of precarity. She really was kind of a broke girl on the Lower East Side. You know, she would find ways, and usually she found other people who would help her out. She was kind of known for not ever really having a job. But she was in a precarious situation like other artists and writers. When she came into her money, she no longer was. And yet her work was circulating, and it was then commercially republished in the 80s. So she was going around representing this version of herself that no longer existed. It's funny, I had that experience myself in a way with I Love Dick. You know, the TV show just streamed this year, but I wrote the book 20 years ago. So it's very odd to be called upon to represent a work that no longer represents you.
When I first met Kathy Acker, oh, it must have been around 50 years ago, I would see her around the Poetry Project at the St. Mark's Church. Many people, she had very unpleasant nicknames behind her back. They would call her Bratty Kathy or Chatty Kathy, and people wanted to escape from her. She was very, very ambitious. And when Kathy enters her life as a commercial writer, money comes to her, clothing comes to her, and she switches, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, from a sense of written style, which is very much her own, inherited from William Burroughs, definitely, but very much her own, to a style that's a fashion style. She bleaches her hair and singes it. She, what does she do to her ears?
Oh, she had multiple piercings. Her appearance became more and more spectacular.
More and more spectacular. She had the most amazing clothes. I know women still who speak of Kathy Acker's wardrobe with such intense admiration, desire, yearning. Your very book, After Kathy Acker, has Kathy's leather jacket on the front cover with a beautiful skull and roses. It has the legend Discipline Anarchy.
Yes. She had that on a tattoo as well.
Yes. Tattooed all over, a gold tooth. She was sometimes beautiful to look at and sometimes hard to look at. I had her on my show. I was very afraid of her, but she was and remained brilliant. She was a vivid conversationalist. You can still hear that show on the website. Did you know Kathy personally?
I didn't really know Kathy. We were in the same room sometimes. We breathed the same air. But we weren't friends. She didn't even know who I was until much later on.
In that early work, she writes herself iconically as someone downtown doing what a downtown writer, poet, artist does, stripping on Times Square at a place, am I right, called Fun City, doing pornographic loops. And she acquires a stream of men, each of whom play a role in the development of her work, but unlike most women, we're talking about women today who've been overwhelmed by the men who took advantage of them. No one really took advantage of Kathy Acker. She was as strong, as forceful, as aggressive as any of them. Could you talk about the experience, her experience with Alan Sondheim?
Yeah. She always led sexually when she met a man. Alan Sondheim, very interesting conceptual artist, still working, still alive. She formed a crush on him, and she thought that she could learn a lot by having an affair with him. So she... They met in New York. He went to her reading. He was impressed. He invited her to dinner. But she initiated this grand project. She wrote him a letter while she was still on the airplane, going back to the West Coast where she lived, confessing her feelings for him, even though they both had other partners at the same time. And so the kind of conduit, the kind of keyhole that she could slip through is, let's do a project together. So she proposed that they make a videotape, which became a work called Blue Tape. So basically, instead of having an affair in real life, they had it on the video. And this was very traumatic for both of them, but I think especially for Sondheim, who, you know, told me that he never fully recovered from that experience.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Chris Krause about her book, After Kathy Acker, A Literary Biography. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Chris Krause about her latest book, After Kathy Acker, A Literary Biography, the story of the nearly mythical writer and creative Kathy Acker. Chris, I'm not exaggerating when I say that I think that this is the best literary biography of a relatively speaking contemporary writer that I've ever read. By the time the later books of Kathy Acker appeared in Memoriam to Identity, Pussy, the King of the Pirates, I had lost a lot of my interest in her. I loved, as you do, The Childlike Life of the Black Tarantula. What a title, and Great Expectations. But these letters that come to her from Jerome Rothenberg, from Jackson McClough, from David Anton, they're mostly from men. Did women feel comfortable with her?
You mean socially or
I mean
artistically?
Intellectually, artistically, emotionally.
I'm not sure. She had this thing. I think what made her work so truly original was you described her pornographic intensity, but it was also an emotional intensity, a directness, this feeling that she's kind of bearing her heart to you on the page in the most direct way, as if it's just you and she talking in a bar late at night. Nobody else did that. She mixed a lot of things. She mixed high and low, and she borrowed a lot from these male avant-gardes, but she came up with something that was so female and so emotional and so original.
Well, did she have female friends?
Well, intermittently, yes, but she didn't keep them. She didn't keep a lot of her friends for long. She would turn a lot of her female friends and peers into her competitors. She felt like there was only room for one. If there was another woman who was coming close to being perceived as she was, she would do her best to annihilate her.
Like Constance de Jong, is that how
yes,
you say
exactly.
The name?
She and Constance de Jong were very close at the beginning of their careers as writers. A lot of similarities between their early work. And she felt that she had to kill Constance de Jong.
It's an amazing story. Maybe a lot of you don't know, but at a reading, there's a politics about who reads first and who reads last. The second reader is thought to be the better reader, the more prestigious reader, the reader that most of the audience has come for, and so they'll stay for the second reader. And there was a kind of war who was going to read first, and Kathy wanted to read second, and Constance de Jong decides, okay, I'll read first. It was a 2-week reading. So the first week it was Constance de Jong, and she reads and she gets a standing ovation, a real standing ovation, and Kathy doesn't come to the second week. She's not willing.
She called in sick.
She called in sick.
To be fair, which I felt like I always had to due as her biographer. To be fair, you have to look at this behavior and then look at the context. And she wasn't wrong that at that time in the culture, there was only room for one exceptional woman. I mean, who were the exceptional women? Or her predecessor, Susan Sontag, was the exceptional woman. There could only be one. There couldn't be a group.
We're only just beginning internationally to be given a sense of who the women writers were. Clarice Lispector did not have a major reputation beyond Brazil during her lifetime. Your own work gathered a following. It was admired, but it didn't attain the radical popularity that I Love Dick has now today. When my guest, Chris Krause, asked if I thought she should do a biography of Kathy Acker, I said, oh, no. Oh, Chris, Kathy always wiped you off the map. You're just asking. This is very masochistic of you. You're just asking for trouble.
Remember that.
In fact, I'm really amazed that you've done a strong but also generous job. When Kathy said to Alan Sondheim, who we were talking about before, I want us to become so close that we become each other. That's what you've sort of done in this book.
It's very witchy, yes.
Oh,
it's very witchy. I mean, I really felt like I was channeling Kathy through the book. I made this decision. I quote her a lot, not just her published work, but her letters, her diaries. And every time I was quoting Kathy, I would put it in italics. So when you look at it, it's like a river. The river of her voice is running through the text.
Wow. Now, by the time you started, her family was mostly dead. I mean, maybe she had a sister who was still alive.
That's true. She had a half-sister.
Yes. But how did you gain access to her persona? You really did. While I was reading this book, I was with both Kathy and Chris Krause's vision of Kathy. And it's almost as if the two of you are in dialogue.
Many of our experiences were so similar. I found that while I was writing the book, she did her first, what she considered her first real major artwork when she was 25. So did I. The title of her work was Politics. The title of my work had politics in the title, Emotion and Politics. Both of us did that. When she was 28, she did work with an elderly woman who had been involved with Zurich Dada. When I was 28, I did a project about the Zurich Dadas. The letter that she wrote to Alan Sondheim in 1974, I realized when I found it, it was so close to some of the letters that I wrote to Dick when I was writing I Love Dick. So there were so many artistic crosses and emotional parallels in our lives. I really felt like I could understand her.
Do you feel that these parallels are things we're beginning to understand as we're starting to understand avant-garde and radical women artists better than we had before?
I think maybe there's a greater receptivity to look at the information rather than to kind of close the door with these stupid cliches.
I am going to praise you and accuse you of a ferocity of intellect in this book. We have been without a major work of literary criticism for maybe 20 years. And let me say it to you and to my listeners, this is it. This is not a work of theory. This is not a work of ideas that go beyond the writer. This is about writing. This is about creativity. This is about the depth to which a writer has to go to come up with an identity in language. Oh, congratulations.
Thank you, Michael.
When you finished, did you know what you had done?
Well, I felt like I was getting very close to her, you know, in working on the book. And it felt really important, something about, you know, doing that, that it was a, like a contemporary woman writer doing it with a near contemporary. That felt important. You know, not somebody 100 years ago, but somebody close enough to be almost considered a competitor.
I want to be very precisely worded here. Her option was to find the men who could help her. This is a different period. And as the author of I Love Dick, there are so many women and so many feminists who've come to respect you. You don't need the men to create Chris Krauss in the way that Kathy Acker needed men to create Kathy Acker. And I think it's one of the reasons this book could be written.
Yeah, that's a very fortunate fact of the present, right? That the culture has changed and there are so many more visible and powerful women thinkers and artists. It's not just about finding, you know, the male mentor who's going to push you forward.
Absolutely. I've been talking with Chris Krauss, author of After Kathy Acker, a literary biography published by Semiotext. Thank you, Chris, for joining me.
Michael, thank you so much.
It's very rare that you read a work of biography or literary criticism that's a page-turner. I was up all night the first night reading the first 150 pages, and I finished the next day. I recommend this book very highly to anyone who's looking for how to waken the creative spirit and have it in his or her life. It's a wonderful book.
Thanks, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from After Kathy Acker, a literary biography, at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. Today, the technical director is Joel Stein. Our usual technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, Sean Sullivan. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.